She stares at me open-mouthed. "You haven't misjudged me, Maya. You've underestimated me. I'm going to pretend this conversation never happened." I half expect her to totter after me as I turn on my heel and stride back to the path. But I've underestimated her, too. She's smart enough to recognize when she's lost a fight. Chapter 6. I'm still in my study at midnight when I hear the door open. I'm cross-legged, nestled amongst the embroidered cantha cushions on the sofa bed and surrounded by the papery cotton of my grandmother's antique quilt. An empty mug of hot chocolate sits inside the triangular gap formed by my folded legs. I look over my shoulder to see Don's head poking around the door. His eyes sparkle in the light of the candle on the table beside me as he steps into the room. The rest of him is shadowy against the inky blue walls. I'm sitting in silence, and he raises his eyebrows so as not to break it. An invitation. I remember our conversation this morning, and try not to sigh. "I'm sorry. I need to spend a couple more hours on this," I say, almost whispering, as if there is someone or something we're trying not to wake. He stares back at me, arms folded, for what seems like an eternity before he speaks.
"Don't you ever think you should spend more time with real people instead of the memories of dying strangers?"
"I'm sorry." I shift my body around so that I'm facing him. After the last argument we had about my job, I'm surprised he would bring it up again.
"I'm trying to prevent a full-blown war in the Pacific, and I seem to work less hours than you. And for what? Giving overprivileged people an artificial shot at redemption?"
"It might seem stupid to you, but it matters to them, and it matters to me." I try to keep my voice level. I'm in no mood for a fight.
"Forget dying. The irony is that you don't have a fucking life, Isabel. You hardly have any friends, and you never spend time with me. You barely see your sister and her family. Her kids probably don't even know who you are. And what gets me is that you treat all this like it's just a waiting room for something better. Well, it's not. This is it."
He opens his mouth to continue, and then seems to change his mind. Making the most of my stunned silence, he leaves, slamming the door shut behind him. I wince and rub my brow, dropping my chin to the springy softness of the quilt wrapped around me. How long have we been like this? 4 years ago, we were enjoying our first dates, the latest bar openings, virtual reality adventures, soda and burgers at old-fashioned bowling lanes, always trying to outdo the other's choice of venue and activity in our inventiveness. I loved his company. We had fun. We didn't talk about work. He was a gentleman. He still is. And he's right. Now we rarely see our mutual friends. The novelty of sharing a bed has faded, and if I'm totally honest, I can't remember why I love him.
"If you ever did,"
a voice whispers, coldly, cruelly, at the back of my mind. I screw up my confusion and launch it towards the thought. I stare at the door. I've lost my concentration, and now I'm distracted by the door handle. I can see from here that it is stuck at an angle rather than lying horizontal. I can ignore it. It's fine. I turn back to what I was doing. It's behind me, out of sight, now. My notes on Yarrick's heaven and the recordings of our conversations are spread out on the glass in front of me. I've already started a list of people we'll need to get in contact with to get double opt-in approval. The name of his wife dances in front of me. Sarah Woods. I murmur it to myself. Yarrick and Sarah. He said very little about her. Yet here she is, on this list, still such a huge part of his life. I feel the brush of his lips against the corner of mine, and my skin bristles with something approximating jealousy. I push the sensation aside. I've seen his criminal record, too, or rather the lack of it. He's been declared free to enter heaven. It's not as easy for some. Convicted murderers, obviously, are automatically out. It's both company policy and the law, too, as it happens. Although I sometimes wonder whether Caleb would abide by the law if he didn't agree with it. I don't think I'd be able to get into the mind of a psychopath anyway. It would lead you down twisting alleys of memories, distort the truth, ask to relive the most awful things over and over again. I rely upon my client's honesty. I'm not sure how lies would translate into heaven. You would have to almost believe it yourself. It would have to become a false memory. There would probably be riots, though, if some of the stories got out. Don would be horrified if I was ever silly enough to tell him about them. Heaven architecture is still so new, and for now, memories of immoral activity cannot be used as evidence. But one day soon, I would like to think that we will be able to offer our insights to courts and law enforcers. It's complicated, though. I'd be happy to provide character references or reveal the content of private conversations if required. But heavens shouldn't be open for inspection, even with a warrant. Once dead and enshrined in their afterlives, I feel that my clients should be untouchable. But Yarrick's record is clean, as I expected. I could have guessed from the openness of his face that he's never been arrested. There may be some complications in creating his heaven because of his tumour, but his consultant is an excellent one. Jess will sort it out. It's the creative side of things that I find harder to do at the clinic. I sometimes need to be in the comfort of this room, near the golden flicker of a jasmine-scented candle, to start pulling it together. It's hard at first, but once you get started, it's instinctive work. Sometimes I'll go through all the notes repeatedly, thinking about them. It's like finding which piece to lay first in a jigsaw puzzle. You need to find something distinctive, something that sits somewhere in the middle of the board, something that links quite clearly to two or three other things. You don't always spot it straight away. I flick through the written words, which have been automatically transcribed from our conversation earlier today. My daughters are the love of my life. I feel again the bizarre pang of envy that I felt when he spoke the words aloud. As before, I let the feeling wash over me while I concentrate on what I'm doing. They are the obvious place to start, his two children. He described each of their births in a lot of detail, which will make it easier for me and his neurologist to build the scene and extract the memories. I close my eyes and lean back, listening to our conversation this time instead of reading the words.
God, they're so beautiful, he says.
I can feel the sunshine of his smile even now. The volume is low, so that it doesn't disturb Don. Now his words are softer. I find myself hanging on the lilt of each one. It's like a lullaby. My eyes are stinging with tiredness, and I stifle a yawn.
They both have this amazing hazel-coloured hair, and it's so damn shiny, like they're tiny woodland animals or something.
We called Helena our little Bambi when she was a baby.
He pauses, laughs.
She had long legs for a toddler, and these eyes straight out of Disney. She looks exactly like my wife. The same brown eyes.
I pause the recording. Now I've heard it for a second time, I can hear the change in his voice even more clearly. How the warm contentedness of it suddenly switches. On a knife edge, It's so sad, I think. That producing children together doesn't make people love each other forever. It should do. It should be like this ribbon of blood that doesn't tie you down, but packages you all up together like some perfect gift that keeps getting bigger and bigger through the generations. But it didn't work for my own parents. It apparently didn't work for Yarick's, and it hasn't worked for him either. I guess love isn't the point of our selfish genes. I could fall pregnant tomorrow, but it wouldn't make me... I let the thought extinguish itself in fear. The room seems colder, and I pull the quilt around my shoulders. I'm too distracted tonight. I can already tell that I'm not going to be able to get much done. I look up, through the open shutters, to the cold, dark glass, and think of the war. I think of all the people who have far bigger issues to contend with than me. I can always find things to be angry at myself for, and selfishness often comes top of the list. A crack. I stand up and walk over to the door, annoyed with myself, and lift the handle until it's straight again. Chapter 7. I wake early. I always do following a late night and broken sleep. My body gives up long before my mind does. I wash and dress in silence, trying not to wake Don. He's leaving again today, but I'll send him a message later to say goodbye. I grab a banana and slip out of the front door into the sunrise glow. It's long before rush hour and there's still a peace in the air. I look up and glimpse at the time, projected onto the hazy blue-white sky, and reflect upon the fact that this will always be a safe time to travel through London. A strike would come at the morning or evening peak to obliterate the most people. The cab is waiting for me on the corner, and its interior lights come on as I run my hand over the door and state my name. It recognizes my voice, and I hear the lock release. I slip into its warm cocoon and sink back into the seat as I give it my destination. I doze for most of the 20-minute journey. By the time I get out of the cab at the gates of the burial ground, the sun is already mounting its claim to the sky. After signing in, I walk along the path that's marked by young yew trees. The clipped grass is smooth underfoot, and the path is straight enough that I can walk with my eyes closed for several seconds at a time. I prefer to listen to the trees rather than look at them. Today, the lightest of breezes stirs the leaves into whispers of old, crumbling tissue paper. You wouldn't want it to be silent here. The sound reminds everyone that life goes on. Near the end of the path, I cut between the yews to the right and walk along the row of small wooden crosses and columns until I reach her spot. I never noticed the upward growth of the sapling, but today it looks fuller. Its slim branches are heavy with green, heart-shaped leaves. I run my hand over the rough, silvery bark, letting my fingertips sink into the dark knots in the swelling trunk. I remember my sister and I planting it, laughing and crying together. Predictably, she wasn't as upset as I was that our mother didn't create a heaven. We never argued about it, though. We never argue because she's the opposite of me, yielding and amenable. It's her death, Isabel. She knows what she wants, and that's all that matters. That was 6 years ago. The tree is taller than me now, I realize. The passage of time seems so cruel. I walk around the tree and kneel in front of it, pressing the flats of my hands into the grass. Now that my grandmother is too frail to accompany me, I don't do what I see others do. I don't chat or leave flowers or tend to the tree. I just sit here for 10 minutes or so, missing her. That is enough. The grass is sun-scorched in places. It hasn't rained much this summer. I press the dried, faded blades between my fingers and remember my mother's fragile skin in those last days. Against all odds, still a deep brown. If she had a heaven, I could imagine her in it. I could sit here, breathing in the chlorophyll, and imagine everything about her. But a heaven is not what she wanted. Lately, I feel more aware than ever that my sadness and regret come from the fact that I wanted her to have a heaven because it would make me feel better. I imagine her wobbling her head, neither a nod nor a shake, and laughing at me in that shrill titter of hers. "You're even more selfish than your sister, Isabel," she would say. She believed in an afterlife, I think. She just never voiced it aloud. I had grown up thinking she wasn't religious, but in her old age she'd made little shrines for the Hindu gods on the bookshelves in the dining room. I found the little golden figures cute, surrounded by candles, slices of fruit and choice flowers cut from the garden. I didn't think too much more about them. Sometimes, in her last months, I would catch her praying. If she noticed me, she'd pull her frail hands apart and press them against the sheets. When I asked her outright why she didn't want me to make her a heaven, she would avoid the question. "I don't want to talk about this silliness any more, Betty." I sigh now, like I did back then, and rise to my feet. Usually I head straight to work in the same cab, but today I have more time than usual, so I decide to stop for a coffee in the Burial Grounds Cafe. I sit outside on one of the wooden picnic tables and look over the energizing expanse of green, letting the trees throw their oxygen at me.
"Well, this is odd."
The voice creeps up behind me, and until I swivel around to see his face, I cannot place it. Yarrick beams at me. He's holding hands with a little girl who is looking up at him, demanding an explanation. I grip my paper coffee cup more tightly, and the heat sears into my hand. The absence of any surprise on his face makes me wonder, somewhat irrationally, whether he knew he would find me here.
"Eleanor, this is my friend, Isabel. Say hello."
He places his hand on his daughter's back and pushes her forward.
"Hello,"
she says, playing with her long plait of hair. She meets my eyes only briefly.
"How old are you, Helena?"
5 and a half.
I glance back up at Yarrick. I'm not good with kids.
"She's off school."
He rolls his eyes as he settles onto the bench opposite me. "The last throes of chicken pox." Now he said it, I can see the tiny, hardened blisters speckled over her forehead beneath the wisps of brown hair.
"Why don't you go and see how high you can get on the swings?"
He points to the small play park beyond the edge of the terrace, and she scampers away. Now that it's just the two of us, I allow myself to recall the sensation of his lips on the edge of my mouth. I feel my cheeks colour.
"This is strange, seeing you here."
I hesitate, and end up using the phrase that I hear other people use here.
"Are you visiting someone?"
"My sister."
The honesty of his gaze draws me to him, sketching in the lines without words.
"She loved nature."
I watch his eyes flick towards the play park.
"And you?"
he asks, looking back at me. "My mother's buried here. I like to visit before work every so often. Did you lose your sister long ago?"
"Oh, it's been years now. She was killed in a collision when she was a teenager."
"I'm sorry, that's awful." I notice that his eyes slope down slightly on the outside. The result is a little hangdog, It's endearing, I decide.
I still miss her,
he adds.
I wish she could have had the chance to have what I'm going to have.
Not everyone is lucky enough to get a heaven. Time, money, circumstance, it all gets in the way.
Nice here, though, isn't it?
I nod. I'm wondering why I mentioned money, and I'm wondering that he will ask me more about it. One of the protesters outside the clinic, a middle-aged man dressed in a shabby overcoat, once grabbed me by the collar with both his hands.
If what you do is so bloody fantastic, you should let everyone have a heaven for free.
I can feel the mist of his saliva condensing onto my face now. All I could do was yell at him to let me go. Caleb called the police that time, and I didn't see the man again. It upset me so much because the exclusivity of what we do is something that has always gnawed at me. Sometimes I can persuade Caleb to do some pro bono work for some of the desperate people who write to us, but it's rare. I have to remind myself that I trained long and hard to get to where I am. It was expensive. I have to make a living. I change the afterlives of the people I can help, if they want it. Yarrick is watching his daughter on the swing. She's leaning forward, her legs dangling over the wood chips. She waves shyly in our direction. She seems in good spirits, considering, I say.
She's over the worst of it now.
I think he's talking about the chicken pox. I had meant the situation. The fact that her father is dying.
Coffee good?
He asks me. I nod and bite the inside of my lip. I've never had a full conversation with a client outside of the clinic before. I know that Leela would tell me to politely excuse myself, but I feel rooted to the spot, like the trees to their graves.
I'm trying to use today to explain everything to Helena, he says. She knows I'm dying, in her own way, and I want her to know she'll be in my heaven.
Perhaps he did follow my meaning, then. I glance back at the little girl. Her mouth is drawn into a line, and she is staring down at her feet as she swings back and forth. It's a lackluster effort, and her sadness is painfully evident. I don't know enough about kids to have any suggestions.
I think she's too young to understand how she can be both here and there at the same time, he says.
She doesn't understand that it's just memories of her in your heaven, I ask him.
I think I've explained it all wrong from the outset. I'm going to have to start from scratch.
He pauses, rubbing at the stubble on his chin. The sound is like the rustle of the leaves.
Do you need a lift back into the city?
No, I lie. But thanks.
Really? I drive an Aston Martin.
It's not even an attempt to con me, because he grins broadly as soon as the sentence is out.
I wish.
Do you even drive? I ask, raising my eyebrows. He laughs and shakes his head.
Of course not. Who does these days?
I'm not sure why he's still here, and I don't know what to say next. We fall into silence as I realise that, without the giveaway laugh or smile, I'd believe anything he says.
But damn what I would do for a 1965 DB5.
He closes his eyes and rests his chin on his fist, dreamlike.
I saw one once at a vintage motor show. Oyster paintwork, cream leather upholstery. The old boy who owned it let me sit inside. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
His eyes pop open then, and he looks at me with an intensity that knocks down the barrier I'm half-heartedly trying to put between us. You've got time, I say. You could hire one, take it out for a spin.
You reckon they'd rent a car like that to a guy with a lapsed license and a brain tumour?
His tone invites me to smile with him. Well, then we could still make it happen, I find myself saying. I could put one in your heaven.
Really? A fake memory?
Yeah, I've done it before.
It can be done. It takes a lot of effort on my part, and I should charge more for it, but it's possible. Especially something material, something he's seen and touched. I realize that I don't want to backtrack on my offer. I'd like to do this for him.
And could I drive it, foot to the floor, top down, full speed, on an empty road?
I smile encouragingly. Are there any limits to your powers, Miss Argent? I shake my head and he grins. He reaches out and places his hands over mine so that we're encircling the coffee cup. It feels like more. It feels like an embrace.
Seriously, though, thank you for all you're doing. I'm so lucky that I found you.
His voice has dropped in pitch. It is gentle but resolute. Thanks. I'm glad you feel that way. I shuffle back on the bench and slip my hands from beneath his. Sorry, I've got to go. I've got an early meeting. I lie again.
Do you have to?
Yes, sorry, I say as I gather up my bag from the top of the table. He looks disappointed.
I'll see you later this afternoon, anyway. I nod.
3 p.m. I walk away through the cafe before I'm tempted to look back at the figure of a dying man sitting alone at a picnic bench. Chapter 8. I'm just walking over to the sofa when I feel the vibration of an incoming call. I press my finger to my ear. Hello?
Izzy!
It's Leela speaking in her clipped business voice. It always makes me smile.
I have your client, Mr. Woods, on the line.
I frown. He's supposed to be arriving for his session any minute now.
Okay, put him through.
I look around for my codec so that I can activate the video stream and we'll be able to see each other.
Yarrick?
I continue to cast my eyes around the room.
Isabel, I'm so sorry. I can't make it today.
His voice is tight and his words run into each other. After he stops talking, deep, ragged breaths fill the silence.
Oh?
I hear the disappointment cloud my voice. Are you all right?
I'm fine,
he snaps, pumping the words out like bullets. And then, as if he can see the bewilderment on my face, his voice softens.
I just wanted to let you know.
I run my fingers along the back of my chair, and then decide to sit down. This obviously won't be a long call, and I may as well stop looking for my codex. I close my eyes and picture his face instead.
Well, thanks for calling.
I pause, because the erratic straining in his voice concerns me.
Are you sure everything is okay?
I've just had an unexpected afternoon, that's all.
There is silence for a while, and I imagine him biting his lip, wondering how best to excuse himself from not just this meeting, but the entire process of creating his heaven. I'm struck by a fear that he won't come back, that I won't ever see him again, and it shocks me.
I was looking forward to seeing you again.
I wince as I say it. I'm grasping for him, and it must be obvious. I momentarily consider whether Leela monitors the phone lines, but it doesn't matter anymore. My embarrassment, my usual professionalism, is stifled by the realization that he is slipping away from me, even faster than he is dying. I wait for him to respond for what seems such a long time. I start to wonder whether he has hung up.
The hours pass so slowly, don't they?
He says, eventually. I look out of the window into the empty grounds, and recall the memory of him walking up the path for our first meeting. The sunlight fell across his face. Today it is overcast, and the threat of a storm presses against the glass. I circle my middle finger against my temple. "I have a headache coming," I tell him. "So perhaps it's just as well. I'll see you next week, though."
"I wouldn't miss it for the world."
My shoulders soften in relief. "I hope your day gets better."
"I hope your headache clears up. Are they bad? Do you get them a lot?"
"No, not often."
"Well, just promise me you'll get checked out if they get worse," he says. "Better safe than sorry."
"Yeah," I say, screwing up my eyes and wishing I hadn't mentioned it. I can be so thoughtless sometimes.
"Thanks for everything you've done so far, Isabel,"
he says.
"You're very special."
I smile then, shaking my head. "No, I'm not."
"You are. If it wasn't for you, I couldn't wait to be in my heaven, away from my illness, away from the mess that is my life." He laughs a little. "That's an irony, isn't it?"
"You'll be untouchable in your heaven, Yarrick." My voice wavers inside my throat, tied up with emotion.
"Untouchable?"
He draws the words out, letting the syllables roll around his tongue. He sounds as though he is smiling. "Absolutely. I promise." The day passes quickly. I manage to avoid both Maya and Caleb, and before I know it, I'm waiting for Leela on the street opposite the clinic. My last session ran over, but I know she'll be even later than me. She always is. I stare across at the protesters. There are 8 of them today, a new record. Their numbers have been bolstered by the arrival of a small, plump woman who grips on to the hand of a toddler. She has been glaring in my direction since she saw me leave the office. I feel too relaxed today to scowl back, but I can feel her eyes on me. It would make more sense to wait around the corner for Leela, but I'm intrigued by the spectacle. I like seeing the people passing by look up at the clinic in confusion, trying to figure out what all the fuss is about. A few push the leaflets into their pocket or bags, but it's clear to anyone that they won't read them. I wonder what makes these protesters turn up every day. It seems like such a waste of life. I slip off my jacket and step out from the shade of the lime tree, closing my eyes against the early evening haze. I hear the doors of the clinic slide apart, and I open my eyes to watch Leela squeeze through the crowd. She dashes across the road through a gap in the traffic, looking sternly at me the whole time.
"Could you not have waited around the corner?" she says as she steps onto the pavement beside me.
I take in the disordered prettiness of her as she presses lipstick on with one hand and clasps her bucket bag in the other. It hangs open, and as she reaches out to me for a hug, makeup falls at my feet. I pick it up for her instead of opening my arms. I shovel everything back into the bag, pulling the drawstrings tight while she finishes applying her lipstick.
"Shall we go?" I ask.
She nods and shakes her black hair out, looping the coloured elastic around her wrist where it joins several other hairbands.
"About the meeting yesterday," I begin, touching her arm.
"Forget it," she says abruptly, without looking at me.
"It's Friday. I've had to talk to that bloody woman all day, and I'm as sick of her as you are. King's Arms or Chalet?"
"I don't mind."
"Well, it's no contest for me. It's a fondue kind of day."
Leela laughs and pulls her bag over her shoulder so that she can link arms with me.
"Chalet it is, then."
We walk in silence to the end of Wimpole Street as the cars roll past. It's a beautiful summer's evening, and the Edwardian townhouses gleam in the golden light. We turn the corner and cut across the road to Chalet. Leela pulls open the rustic wooden door and pushes me inside before her, whispering over my shoulder as she does so.
So, my management hat is off.
Who's this handsome new client of yours?
I glance back at her and roll my eyes.
Inside, it's already busy, and we find a couple of bar stools at the back of the main room. The air is thick with the aroma of molten cheese and evaporated alcohol.
We'll be in a stupor within minutes, I joke. Shall we order now?
Leela asks.
She knows I'd rather knock back the wine, but she's right. I should eat. And Don isn't at home to cook something for me.
Although I always find packages of food in the freezer, labelled up with the ingredients and date, signed off with a kiss.
Sure, shall we share one?
She nods, and I grab the attention of a passing waiter to order a fondue and a bottle of our favourite white wine, which appears within moments.
How's Don?
I shrug. You know, here and there, he works hard.
Almost as hard as you, I'd guess,
Leela grins. Even she recognises that what he does is more important, if there is a scale. I look down at the table and wonder when it became a competition.
Everything okay with you two?
Yeah, fine. I cast my gaze around the bar, looking everywhere apart from at Leela's probing eyes.
We just don't do anything together anymore. He keeps out of my business and I keep out of his. I'm not sure that's how it's supposed to be. Anyway, how's your lovely husband?
Leela pauses and narrows her eyes at me before answering. I think she's deciding whether to press me further.
Oh, he's fine, she says eventually. Getting impatient for kids, though.
You're still not keen?
I just can't seem to summon up the enthusiasm is. And the way the world is at the moment...
Leela plays with her earlobe, squashing and rolling it between the pads of her fingers.
She doesn't have to say any more. I know what she means because we've talked about it before, when the Cold War against China started to heat up at the start of the year. She's too scared to bring a child into such an uncertain time in history. Perhaps we're prematurely concerned, but I'm sure we're not the only ones. Things are okay for now, perhaps, but the tension is mounting. I can see it in the faces of people on the streets. I can feel it ricochet through a crowd whenever there's a sudden loud noise or a siren.
So?
Leela taps her nail on the table. She doesn't want our catch-up to be drowned in melancholy.
Your client?
Leela, what about client confidentiality?
I'm not asking for details, she says,
always so indignant.
I just want you to admit that he's the sexiest client you've ever had.
I laugh and lift the glass of wine to my lips, sucking it through my teeth and focusing on the bite of the alcohol at the back of my tongue.
He's good looking, I'll give you that.
Leela realizes that she's not going to be able to draw me further on the subject, and her salacious grin fades.
We've had some younger ones recently, haven't we?
I nod. It's sad. I find it hard to believe that there are still things we can't cure.
Yeah, it's tough.
I think about how Yarrick cracks jokes about dying, and how they only serve to heighten evidence of his own disbelief at what is happening to him. Older clients are so much more accepting, more grateful about what I can achieve for them. And it's so much simpler to create their heavens. They often just want the reality of their lives as it comes. Perhaps they are old enough to have accepted that the rough comes with the smooth, experienced enough to have seen that life is defined by its contrasts, not by the moments of joy alone. The half-light of the summer evening rolls into darkness as we gossip and drink ourselves silly. It always takes several glasses of wine before I can feel a fading in the tension that so defines me. The neatness unfurls, and we splutter with laughter over the candle on our table.
I stop caring that my shirt is getting flecked with splashes of wine and spots of grease. We're halfway through our third bottle when Leela falls over on the way back from the toilets and we decide it's time to go home. We order taxis before stumbling back out onto the street, pushing past the noisy queue of people still waiting to get in.
"There is something about him, you know," I hear myself saying.
"Who?"
Leela scrunches up her face in confusion, and her eyes disappear into their sockets.
"My client, Yarrick."
"Oh, I know. I've watched you show him out. I've seen the way you look at him."
My cheeks are already warm from the wine and the heat of the crowded restaurant, but I feel a fresh fever spreading through my face. Leela is perceptive, dangerously so. As our taxis pull up, I remember I've left my jacket over the chair inside.
"My jacket!"
I call to Leela as I turn back inside. By the time I return, a few moments later, she's already gone. I slip inside my taxi, feeling alone and drunk. My emotions are amped up now, and I try to beat them down against the dopamine bouncing off the sides of my skull. I lean forward to speak my address into the dashboard before slumping back against the imitation leather seat. As soon as I let myself relax, Yarrick is in every particle of air in this dark space. I struggle to fill my lungs with the oxygen I need to fend him off. I know I can breathe, but I'm learning to breathe a new kind of substance. I'm choking on something quite wonderful. I close my eyes and give myself over to it, to him. I take my memories from our two meetings, the time at the burial ground and today's brief chat, and caress my imagination over them, sculpting them into a fantasy. I run my hands through his hair, pull the pad of my thumb along his jaw. He towers above me and pulls me into him. I twist the wedding band on his finger, and it falls to the floor. My eyes flicker open, the cells of my retina grasping for something, anything, in the gloom. The display at the top of my vision tells me it's 3 a.m. I feel it again, the gentle agitation against my jugular that woke me up. It's an urgent message. Something is wrong. And that usually means that someone has died. I pull myself up from underneath the sheets, arranging them under my arms and plumping up the pillows behind me. I glance at the empty space beside me and smooth my hand over the creases in the pillow. I feel a sense of relief that Don doesn't have to see me like this. He hates it when I've had too much to drink. I blink into the darkness, bracing myself. My head throbs, but I'm still a little drunk. The nausea I'm expecting doesn't come. I lean back against the headboard and take a couple of deep breaths. Preparation is everything. I unfurl my codex, and there's the message. Yarrick. There's a part of me, still dozing, that's not surprised in the slightest at the tightening of my chest. My toes squeeze against each other, and the cramp spreads through me. It tugs at my heart where so few of my clients reach. He can't be dead. No, 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 not yet. Then I realize that the message is from him, not about him. The two words call out at me, flickering with laughter.
"You're awake!"
It's not a question.
Of course it's not, because he's aware that by flagging his message as urgent, it's woken me up.
An aggravated passion rattles in my belly as I talk, the words appearing as silent text on the screen. My voice scratches in my throat. I thought someone had died.
"Sorry."
The ellipsis flashes for a few seconds. I know before the rest of the sentence appears that this is his attempt at comedic timing.
"Not yet."
I find myself running a fingertip over the words on the screen, feeling it buckle like skin with the pressure of my touch. I sink beneath the sheets again, waiting. Waiting for the reason a client would write to their architect in the middle of the night.
I wanted to ask you something. I need to know what your heaven is like.
I should decline. I should put my codex down and go back to sleep. But need is a word that's hard to ignore. It pulses in front of me, shimmering potently, offering a transfer of power. My life is so simple. I get up, I have breakfast, I wear almost the same outfit every day, a loose-fitting suit with a crisp white shirt tucked into the waistband of the trousers, maybe a camisole underneath if it's cool out, matching underwear, obviously, flats or low heels, tinted lip balm, bronzer, eyeshadow, eyeliner, and mascara. I go to work, I create things for people, meaningful things, comforting things, at least I hope so. I talk to them about it, I write notes, I update my boss, I go to the occasional meeting, I come home, I go to bed with my boyfriend, I talk to my sister on the phone once a week. At the weekends, I work, clean the flat, listen to music, occasionally see friends. My life is ordered, and yet, despite my fastidiousness, it remains inelegant. I don't need to start a battle. I already feel like I'm constantly at war with myself.
Please, I need to know.
It wouldn't be right. I'm lucky he can't hear the tone of my voice. I barely convince myself.
I've got all these ideas, but I'm floundering. It would help me if I could see what someone else's heaven was like.
That's normal. I'm here to help. In our sessions, I almost summon the willpower to roll my codex shut, but his next words appear almost immediately.
I don't think I've got long left.
But my heaven's not finished. I'm still creating it, I whisper. As I watch the words appear, I know that this is a poor excuse. I should tell him that it's not appropriate for an architect to share such details with her client. But who am I to keep it from him? I tell myself that Yarrick is a dying man, a man that needs me. He is my responsibility now. I pull the codex underneath the sheets with me, and I whisper. Chapter 9. It's 3 days before I see him again, and they drag. I have more nightmares. Planes and drones and shadowy soldiers trample through my sleeping mind. Sometimes Don doesn't come home at all, and I wake up sweating, reaching out for him, before I remember that I'm stuck inside a bubble of my own turmoil. I am falling for a man, a married client, I barely know. And yet I feel like I need Don's reassurance. There's a residual attachment that won't fade. I worry about him. I worry about what will happen to us. And then the worry scatters into a sky of stars, beneath which I'm threaded into Yarrick's limbs, like a jigsaw. Yarrick has been with the neurologist. The first neurons of his memories have been patched into a computer. The integrity of his mind has been checked. The process is all so straightforward that it's easy to forget that Yarrick is dying. He will be dead. His body will decay, and he will forever be in a heaven that doesn't even know my name. I can't think those thoughts without pushing my fingernails into my lip. I wait for him now, my hands gripping the sofa. I'm torn, and I feel like it's visible in every aspect of my appearance. I know I look exhausted. There are shadows under my eyes, yet I've swiped a hazy pink lipstick over my mouth. I dressed in a black lace basque this morning, but then I told myself I was going crazy and threw on a tired old suit that's too big for my frame over the top of it. But I put on heels instead of my flats. As I wait, his name appearing repeatedly, insistently on the tip of my tongue, my hands move from the edge of the seat to my hair, unfurling it before I change my mind and scoop it back again to the nape of my neck. All I can think is that I told him about my heaven. But when he walks in, the words come more easily than I expected. Hello, how are you?
I'm tired.
I didn't need him to tell me that. It's evident as soon as I look at him. Exhausted is probably closer to the mark. Even the usual warmth of his smile falters against the sun streaming into my office.
But you look beautiful, like you always do.
He says it slowly enough that I believe him. He doesn't lower his eyes, and it's me that must look away.
The sessions with Dr. Sorbonne went well,
he continues, as I fight the flush from my cheeks.
At least, I think they did.
She assures me they did.
She said that the car, the DB5, is coming along nicely.
Yes, I've been working on it today. I think it's looking really good. We talk, and it's like the part of me that will enter my own heaven one day is floating above me, looking down on us. We're sitting only inches apart, and our heads are inclined towards each other. Our knees almost touch. I shuffle every so often as the bones of my basque dig into my ribs. One minute, I can't bear to look into his eyes, and seconds later, I'm not able to tear my gaze away again. We go through more details about what he wants, how he wants his heaven to look. He wants all the seasons and the climbing frame he played on with his brothers when he was a child, and the memory of his mother washing him at the sink, cleansing his childhood scrapes of gravel and dirt. He wants to remember the first time he made love to a girl, even though he no longer knows her, and so she'll be an anonymous figure, unable to opt in to his memories. But he will feel the heat of her body, the nerves and the elation. He will hear the nervous giggling afterwards. He wants to play rugby with his best friends. I can get their opt-in this week, I tell him. And eat the incomparable fillet steak he once had at a tiny restaurant in Florence. And sneak another sip of the warm cider that his grandfather used to brew in the cellar. He wants to remember playing with his sister in their youth, amongst the pine trees at the back of the family home, before their parents sent them off to separate boarding schools, before the accident. He wants to relive that big win at the blackjack table in Las Vegas, and remember the night that he dropped acid with a stranger in Argentina. He wants, of course, to feel the love of the crowd around him as he danced his first dance at his wedding. And to watch the birth of each of his daughters. He ponders over the doomed love affairs of his younger years. Somehow the jealousy I feel becomes overwhelmed by his honesty. One girl is definitely in, and then out again, and his regrets mount, but he tells me he'll think about it and let me know. I'll get in touch with her anyway, I say. I'm sure she'll feel flattered. My throat is dry, and I realize I've drunk a whole glass of water in the space of a few minutes. Every so often he clenches his jaw and his eyes harden, and I realize he's in pain. It hurts? I ask him on the third occasion that I see him flinch.
No one said dying was easy, he replies, eyes shining through his feigned seriousness.
No, but it's much easier than it used to be.
Yes, I know.
His expression closes down and his voice softens.
But I'm getting bored with it. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to get out of here.
And I want to shake him. I'm rendered selfish, caught up in the realization that sitting with him here in my office is the most alive I've ever felt.
You have to make the most of this time, Yarrick. I can hear my tone suggesting more than the words I am speaking. I'm trying to tell him to throw caution to the wind. I am calling him to me. I am crazy. I have actually lost my mind, I think.
Isabel?
You can call me Izzy. Iz.
You said that the timelessness of heaven would make me feel free.
Yes, I did. It will, I say. And I see that his hand is resting on my thigh above the knee.
Did he really do that? How did he put it there without me noticing?
I tense the muscle so that I don't shake. There is peace in the room for a minute or so. And I mean peace, rather than silence. It's an easy noiselessness which consumes Yarrick's need to crack jokes and absorbs my terror. It leaves only a soft pulsing current between us that could also just be the blood rushing against my ear canal.
How do you know?
How do I know? I know because it would, wouldn't it? The passing of time is the root of all our anxieties. We hate getting old, we rush around trying to get everything done. We try to control the future by improving ourselves. If we could just live in the moment absolutely and completely, wouldn't that be perfect happiness? He is silent for some time.
I've been thinking.
I can see his jaw work as he gnaws the inside of his cheek.
I don't want my wife in my heaven.
You don't? I try to keep my voice level as my brain clouds with questions. I feel his voice, as if by osmosis, through my skin.
But he is still my client. I am still his architect.
No, I don't.
I try to mentally push myself away from him. I bring the architect in me back to the forefront and let Isabel slide, protesting, to the back of my thoughts. There are many people who only want happier memories of their loved ones to appear to them after their deaths. But this is complete censorship. It will be tricky to separate out those memories, to erase her from his other recollections. I think of Don and the way he looks at me. As unlikely as it is, I know that if he decided to have a heaven, he would want me in it. And I wonder, not for the first time, whether I would want to let him.
Can I ask why?
It's barely a whisper.
Why do you think?
His tone challenges me, and I can't bear it. A weight of responsibility sinks over my shoulders, pinning me to the sofa. This is why you don't get too close to your clients. I feel a perplexing panic rise like bile in my chest, and I glance at the clock. I've never finished a session early. I can't finish this session early, can I? I struggle to hold my lips together. I imagine I look like a goldfish gasping for air and stumble back from the caricature I've just created. I'm sorry, Yarrick. I've just realized I have an appointment. I'll schedule you in again in a couple of days. I jump across the words as if they are stepping stones in a stream rising above the current. I grasp at my bag on the back of the door and fling it over my shoulder as I gesture him out of the room. He hasn't left the sofa, but has swiveled to face me in a kind of amused astonishment. I flush.